everybody, and welcome back to the IBS Freedom Podcast. I am joined by my amazing co-host, Amy Hollenkamp, RD.
Hello, everybody. Woo.
And we are here to take a deep dive into probably, honest to God, one of the most controversial topics in this space, which is candida slash yeast. But my God, who here has not been diagnosed with candida? Right? Like, that is just such a thing. Like, even before you get testing done, I feel like so many integrative docs and naturopathic people and herbalists and acupuncturists, like, all of us are like, ah, you got candida. And I don't know. I think that it's a more nuanced conversation than that. I suspect that you might feel that way as well. But Amy, tell me about your experience with candida. Because were you ever diagnosed with candida as part of your healing journey? I think you were, right?
For sure. Well, I've kind of, I self-diagnosed myself with candida. That was like the first thing I thought was going on.
Which could be a slippery slope, self-diagnosing yourself.
Oh,
first
for
of
sure.
All.
So like you know, there is a website, I think it might be called like candidadiet.com. It's like the most generic, like hatred of anything carbs, like mentality on that website. So I went there, which was not a good choice because I went off the deep end diet wise. Yeah. I believe for like the first 5 to 7 days, they tell you not to eat any meat. So it's literally just like broth and vegetables.
Okay. And then what's the rationale with the meat? Do you remember what the rationale with the meat?
Who knows? I have no idea. But I do remember it was like just vegetables. And like maybe some broth, but nothing else besides that. Then you add in the meat and then you kind of layer things in, but like total fear of sugar and carbs began at that point, I feel like for me, because it's so, the mentality in this, the candida space is so anti-sugar, anti-carb in general.
Well, it's so very similar to the SIBO space, right? Like if you kill it, they will win and you will lose. End of story.
Right. So I was definitely in that mindset. I did terribly on low carb, but kept pushing through thinking this was all die off or something, you know? Oh, I'm tired. It's just, it must be working. You get into like this deranged mindset. I feel like I know I was where it's like, I thought that because I felt bad, it was working, but it definitely was not. And, but then I went in the SIBO route, and there could have been some candida there at some point, who knows, but I went the SIBO route, and when I treated with antibiotics, then I actually did have a horrible candida fungal issue after that, where I was actually getting, like, nail fungus popping up, some other infections elsewhere. So I had nail stuff going on. I had like horrendous brain fog that I think was heavily associated. I think there were other things at play with my brain fog too, but for me, antibiotics really triggered fungal issues, and I took like Cipro. So it wasn't even Rifaximin or the common ones. It was like the most heavy duty antibiotic I could have possibly taken. Yeah. I took for SIBO, and then my candida very much flared following that.
Yeah.
So that's generally my story. I do find that in the integrative functional space, there's often like an either or situation that people try to like pinpoint from a practitioner. Like usually I'll see someone, they're like, oh, I have a fungal issue or I have a SIBO issue. Like they're not necessarily, there's usually not as many people coming to tell me they have both and that both need to be addressed. It's usually like they choose one lane or the other and they're sticking with that lane, even though if they both are present, they might both need to be addressed in some way, in multiple different ways. So that's generally what I see as like a practitioner is that. I think at the beginning too, candida was the big diagnosis before SIBO. And then SIBO's kind of come in and become a big diagnosis as well. So
SIBO
there's
is
kind
the
of
new candida.
Exactly. SIBO is the new candida. So it's almost like everyone's getting diagnosed with SIBO. And candida, I feel like it's a little bit less of a focus from what I've seen lately. I don't know if you feel the same the same way.
Sort of. I think it depends very much on the practitioner you see.
Right, right.
And I think that's where people come in and they're like in one lane or the other. I think it's like there are practitioners who are really crazy passionate about candida and they think everybody has candida.
Right,
And so,
right.
surprise, surprise, all their patients get diagnosed with candida somehow. And then
Right.
there are the people like I am a little bit of a SIBO phobe, so I tend to think SIBO more readily than others, perhaps. But there are certainly people who are like, oh, you have any gut problems whatsoever? Automatically SIBO, boom.
Right.
And that's not the case. It's not that simple. And then there's also the wide world of small intestinal fungal overgrowth, SIFO, which is like a whole nother topic altogether. We'll have to do a whole separate issue on that, or episode rather, on that probably. But I would say that candida and yeast, well, I would offer this first, is that yeast is a normal inhabitant of the gut microbiome for humans. So don't, the mission is never to be totally candida free or yeast free.
Right,
That
right.
probably would be a bad thing for our immune system or our gut or our microbiome, who knows. But we also know a heck of a lot less about candida and yeast than we do bacteria. And that's saying something because we don't actually know that much about bacteria. There's like 50% of the gut microbiota is not named yet. Like we've observed, oh, there's like this other 50% of the bulk of the bacteria in your gut. We know you're there. We just haven't classified you or understood you or named you yet. So we're just going to kind of like nod our head at that. So if 50% of the bacteria in your gut are not even named yet, I mean, I feel like candida and yeast in the gut is actually like this big, what is the line that they say? Like the last frontier almost. Like it's so unexplored, really. And I think it probably does a disservice that the integrative and naturopathic field is willing to just label everybody with candida. I think that's probably hindered the progress of that area in the field because you have the hippy dippy people who are like, everybody has candida, end of story, sugar is bad, carbs are bad. And then you have the conventional world who's like, no, you know, like unless you have a vaginal yeast infection or visible thrush or can, you know, yeast-based sepsis, like they don't think anybody has candida.
Yeah, unless
And
you're severely immunocompromised, is the term that like I feel like I've heard the conventional system say about fungal issues.
just if you're immunocompromised. End of story.
Yeah, I mean again, there's such like a I feel like middle road that we like that I think we both like to find with working with people. And I think in a similar way as SIFO or even Candida in general gets this blanket like, oh, if it's there, you need to like starve it and kill it. Like, it's a very similar mentality. And what you're saying, and I'm in total agreement with, is it's such a delicate balance. And I think even with Candida, like you're saying, we don't know as much about what this means that this level's high or this level's or this particular fungal microbe compared to this fungal microbe. Is this one okay? Is this one not? Like, we don't know all the nuances, even less so than the we'd know about bacteria. So yeah, it's definitely mismanaged in the functional
Horrendously.
integrative space, which is a real bummer, and then it's totally ignored in the conventional space. So taking this middle road of a more nuanced approach of, okay, what does this mean if you have a fungal overgrowth? What are the layers of this? What systems could be down if you have candida or a fungal overgrowth? Like, all this stuff needs to be explored. Sometimes some more like clearing approaches are helpful, sometimes not. It just kind of depends on the person. And so,
It's
yeah.
probably like SIBO in the sense too, like the people who truly have an overabundance of the microbe are like if you truly have like a hundredfold higher amounts of, say, candida, then those are probably the situations where people are likely to get benefit from the eradication protocols and things like,
Right.
you know, caprylic acid, or not Uvercy, what's the other one I'm thinking of?
Ondesiclinic, that one.
Yeah, that's actually one of my favorites.
Me
There's
mine
another thing.
too.
I have a brain fart right now, but Yeah. You know, there's like a handful of things that everybody uses for candida.
Right.
And I do think that there are people who, you know, if you go on Amazon reviews and you look at these anti-candida products, for example, you'll see a bunch of 5 stars and people saying, oh my God, it gave me my life back. The brain fog lifted. I feel amazing. But then there's also the people who are like, well, like I've had candida for years and I can't get rid of it. It still shows up on test results, or I still have all these symptoms. Maybe it wasn't the candida after all. And those are the situations where I'm like, maybe you have fungal dysbiosis. Like, maybe there's an imbalance between the good and the bad yeast, because yes, there are good yeasts that keep the worst ones in check.
Right.
Or maybe it's more of a bacterial dysbiosis, or an immune issue, or a gut issue, gut brain axis. You know, there's like a million other things that can go in that. But if we're just taking a test, like a stool test or an oat test, and we're just saying, oh, yep, you have an overgrowth, and treating everybody as though they have a true overgrowth, we're probably missing the boat for a lot of people. And that's at least been my observation clinically.
Right. And I think of the main systems that are usually out of whack when there is a fungal issue. I think usually there might be some immune deficiency, like in SIBO or other imbalances, like the immune system in the gut is shot, so it's having a hard time regulating what's growing, what's not. I think things like thyroid issue, crispy adrenal issues, like you like to call
exactly.
it. So it's the stress response, I think, can play a big role. And I also think just generally what's going on with the microbiome as a whole, what's the ecology like? Because if you have low levels of good microbes, you have like dysbiosis in the bacteria, it's there's more often than not, the fungal stuff can start to creep up. So it,
yeah.
So there's just a lot of layers and nuance, as I'm sure we're talking about, that you understand. And it,
well, there's like checks and balances, right? Sorry to cut you off.
Yeah, no, like, right.
There should be things like your body should have protective mechanisms to make sure that your candida don't get too rowdy. And the same thing, like you should have checks and balances to make sure your bacteria don't get too rowdy and you don't develop SIBO. So yes, you can kill the SIBO, but then you have to ask, what checks and balances do I need in place so that it never comes back? And I think the same is true for candida.
Right, 100%. Like, we have our own defense systems in place, and all those systems need to be up and running in order to keep everything happy and healthy gut-wise.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, I'd also like to talk a little bit, too, and I mentioned it in my story as well, with the diet side of things for fungal issues and all the drama with the diets, because I mean, I almost think it's more so than SIBO, where I feel like people with candida wouldn't touch like a fruit with a 10-foot pole because they're scared about the sugar content. And again, I was there. I was in that same scenario.
It's terrifying.
It's terrifying. I was there for sure. And I mean, the main thing that is problematic there, similarly to the SIBO scenario, is that first off, your body needs nutrition and you need to be well nourished. And a lot of times if you're dipping really low carb, it's going to cause cortisol to become dysregulated. It's going to cause thyroid hormones to decline. So you're going to have all these downstream hormonal effects that are going to affect motility and affect gut function. And you're not feeding good microbes in the gut. And even immune function can take a hit. So all the systems that you need to keep candida away oftentimes get suppressed when you're going too low carb. And it's just crazy and a nightmare.
Man.
Yeah. So I'm sure, tell me kind of your experience with some of the dietary aspects that you've seen with your clients.
Yeah. I mean, it's very similar. I think that, you know, it's like things had to get just squirrely enough to get candida. Assuming, like, let's go on down the road and assume that people who have candida legitimately have an overgrowth of candida.
Right.
And it's not like a dysbiosis scenario. So yeah, things had to get wonky enough. Obviously, medical diagnosis here, wonky enough to lead to that overgrowth. But then the things that are done to treat the overgrowth, I think, make it worse. Like, if you're not feeding And I'll tell this to all of my patients with candida until my face turns blue, and some will listen and some won't.
Right.
But if you are restricting like whole grains and, you know, roots and tubers and things like fruit and vegetables, and, you know, if you're restricting all of those fiber sources, then guess what? You're not going to feed your good bacteria, like Lactobacilli being the big one, but there's others as well. You need your good bacteria to put the kibosh on the growth of candida, point blank. That's probably your number one defense mechanism against candida overgrowth is your microbiome and its diversity and its health and its metabolites. And if you starve the candida very, very frequently with the strict candida diets, you're going to starve your good microbes, and then you're left. And it's like, well, you could try to eat yogurt or something, but I don't know. I don't think that we quite have the probiotic game figured out yet that we can match the effectiveness of just feeding your resident bugs. Like, I think that's always going to surpass any probiotic that we can take. So, yeah, you know, you could take lactobacilli in a pill, or you could take it as a yogurt or something, but ultimately, you're probably going to want to feed those lactobacilli and feed those good bacteria again and get that up and running. And then also, I would say, too, the other part is that A, the bacteria directly suppress and modify the growth of candida and yeast species,
Yeah,
but
right.
also they're going to affect the inflammatory environment and the immune environment, and you kind of need your immune system to tackle candida, and it's going to affect the gut barrier function and whether or not you have leaky gut. And candida all by itself is actually not a super, super, super big deal. If you have candida overgrowth plus leaky gut, like, that's a whole nother kit and caboodle, and now you're off to the races in a really bad way.
Yeah.
So that's the thing, is like, if you restrict your diet too much, you're gonna make yourself more prone to a leaky gut, because now you don't have that microbiota diversity, and you're not getting the direct inhibition from the bacteria, but you're also not getting a nice healthy gut lining and a nice healthy immune system. And now it's all out the window at that point. And I see people who are just stuck, and they're still terrified of food because, again, every website or every guru on the internet is, or a naturopath is telling them that carbs are bad. And it could be a really scary place to be. And I see a lot of people get stuck there.
Right, and I do think it's important to note too, as you've said in the past, and microbes will find things to feed on, and yeast are similar. I mean, they can feed
They're
off
smarter than us.
ketones. Yeah, they can feed off ketones and fat. So like, you can't really starve it out. You can bolster the systems that help keep it in check, as you're saying, but you can't starve it. This idea that you can is really false. And you'll just end up starving yourself and starving these systems that really need to be in place to keep it in check.
Yeah, I think
So,
that practitioners and individual people have the best of intentions, but and they
right.
don't realize it. But I think 90 plus percent of the time, the efforts to treat the candida end up pushing people further into the dysfunction that gave them candida to begin with. And then that's how they
Right.
find us. That's how people find us, and they've had candida for years, and they're like, WTF, what do I do now? And, you know, it's really tough, because I've certainly seen those patients who are terrified to eat food and any little bit of sugar, you know, whether it really is feeding the candida and exacerbating symptoms in that way, or if it's some other mechanism, they can get very sensitive to sugar after eliminating it for years and years and years. And I've seen those patients, and it's a really slow game. And I think adding in things that are not sugary, but like polyphenols, for example, to feed the gut microbiota first, and then
Yeah.
gradually working your way into things that might be considered like carby or sugary. It's got to be a little bit of a process, but it can be pretty painstaking to go if you don't have some sort of supervision or an unbiased opinion to help guide you.
Right. And I do think what you're saying is really important to take note of, that like from the mental side of things, if you cut something out for a while, you could have some symptoms when you're reincorporating it in. And I believe we've talked about this in the past, but coming to some acceptance of this is going to be a process, and that's hard to do mentally on your own because it can be very easy if you add in these foods and you're like, oh no, like I'm having the exact same symptoms that I had before. I must be feeding the candida. I need to stop this. So you just go back into that habitual pattern of eliminating sugar or carbs.
Yeah.
And the mental side of it, especially I feel like in the fungal space, is almost harder to overcome because there's so much fear. And so
yeah.
You're totally right. There is an aspect of it that you're going to have an adjustment phase with reintroducing things.
Yeah.
And it's going to take a little bit of time. And having the right support through that, I feel, is very important.
Yeah.
Because, again, there might be foods you need to chill on a little bit. Like, if it's causing a ton of symptoms and being really disruptive, like, that, if I was working with someone, I would say, oh, we might want to, like, hold up on that or, like, reduce dose or change things around and give some guidance.
Yeah.
But if there's no guidance there and you're on your own, that's really tough.
Well, and like, there could be pattern recognition to it too. Like, okay, if somebody hasn't eaten fruit in 3 years and now they're trying to eat fruit and they get symptoms and feel crappy when they eat, you know, strawberries and mango, well, maybe it's not the sugar. Maybe you have a histamine issue. And maybe that needs to be looked at. Versus if you haven't eaten sugar in years and now you eat an apple and a peach and you get symptoms, well, maybe it's a FODMAP thing and we have to evaluate for SIBO as well as candida. So even something like that, like having somebody who knows what they're doing and knows that pattern recognition where you could start like thinking outside of the current thing that you're thinking of. Like if you are so in the zone of candida, 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 and sugar is evil, it could be hard to see other patterns and pick up on other things. And I think that that's really beneficial. And I would say this too, as a side note, I think that part of the reason why candida is worse, and I agree with you on that, I think that there's more food fear in the candida world than there is in the SIBO world, which is saying a lot.
Yeah.
But I think it's worse because it's not that hard of a mental jump to make. I think that pretty much like the state of nutrition, thankfully, this is overall a good thing, but the state of nutrition, at least here in the States, we're finally getting wise to the whole idea that like, oh, the low-fat campaign of the 1980s and 90s was actually hot garbage.
Yeah.
And fat is not intrinsically evil, but we were taking the fat out of, you know, what was like snack wells and putting in a ton of sugar. And now I think like even the general public is starting to recognize that sugar is not good for you, which is great if you're talking about like a Twix or ice cream or something like that.
Right.
So I think it's because there's not as much of a mental jump to go from one, you know, like one world or like the whole world now basically saying like, yeah, sugar's pretty bad for you, actually. Like we should refrain. To go from that into all sugar, including fruit sugar, including carbs, which are metabolized into sugar. Like, it's just, like, one more jump. Versus with the FODMAP and the SIBO thing, I think there is a little bit more of, like, an intrinsic, going on. Like, I know when I first started working with SIBO and I was recommending the low FODMAP diet, thank God, not for very long, but I remember having that mental disconnect where I was like, how the hell does this make sense? Why all of a sudden are apples bad for you if you have SIBO? Like, I never could wrap my head around the idea that fruits and vegetables are intrinsically bad for you, even if you have a medical condition. And I started kind of mentally chewing on it and exploring the idea that, well, wait, maybe this is just a band-aid and you can actually like treat SIBO without doing this horrible diet. So I think like it's a little bit further of a mental jump to get to the point where you really believe that like asparagus is harmful for you versus, you know, sugar is bad. And we're all kind of sipping that Kool-Aid now, which is overall, I think, a good thing. But for the candida space, you know, no, sugar from fruit is generally not going to be super treat. At least in my experience, I think that that's more healing than anything else for even the candida folk.
Right. Yeah. I get what you're saying. It's almost like a black and white mentality than taking to the candida. I totally get that mentality. And I think that it's interesting, and we can talk a little bit about maybe the blend of like SIFO and SIBO, which might want to do a full podcast like you had mentioned before. But I do find that there's certain situations working with clients where there's a for sure a SIBO situation. So SIBO's present. And then I'm highly suspective of a SIFO situation just by certain symptoms I'm seeing, certain reactions I'm seeing. And again, sometimes we'll test and confirm that. But I do find that, especially in the conventional space, so if someone's coming from a conventional standpoint, they're not really, SIFO or fungal issues are not on the radar. And so there's a lot of conventional treatment, which is antibiotics, which I think can sometimes flare the SIFO situation. But I just think it's important to note that, like, I think one study that looked at, SIBO and SIFO, and like if there was an overgrowth, what percentage had SIFO and SIBO? I know that in that study, it was like 43% who had a positive SIBO test, or I think it was actually culture study, but who tested positive for SIBO, had fungal issues too, so had SIFO. So 43% is a pretty high number. And again, what you're saying too, there could be just immune issues going on that's leading to the overgrowth of SIBO and like leaky gut and those issues from SIBO driving some of the SIFO, and there's a lot of interactions in there. But do you tend to see a lot of people recognizing that they have both SIBO and SIFO?
Not a lot. I think more often than not, I'm the one bringing it up. I think, I think about it a lot more. I think about bringing up the topic. Sometimes, honestly, sometimes I don't even go there. Even if I suspicion, even if I suspicion, suspect, suspect it.
Suspicion?
Even if I suspicion it,
Yeah,
sometimes I don't
exactly.
go there because I don't want people to Google Candida and fall
Right.
down the rabbit hole, especially with
Right.
my really anxious patients who Google a lot. Like it could be a bit of a scary path to go down, and I make the conscious decision to not go there unless I really need to bring their awareness to it, and instead I will just cunningly use herbs that are good at bacterial and yeast overgrowths. So I'm kind of like treating a teeny bit out of curiosity, but I'm not bringing it up because I don't want to send them into a full-blown anxiety panic attack over the Candida thing. But more often than not, I would say I'm the one bringing it up if I am bringing it up. Because I don't think there's quite that awareness, certainly not from the conventional space, none whatsoever.
And it just makes you wonder too, because I like what you're saying about going down more of the herbal route, which, of course, I'm partial to herbals versus antibiotics. But I think that a lot of the herbal, even some of the like common formulations of the herbals that are used for SIBO, I'm thinking like FC-Cytal, Dispiocide, even Candibactin ARBR, obviously like have a Candida aspect to them. So I think that they're probably more effective at taking out some of the yeast versus the antibiotics that don't. So I think again, like and maybe this is just personally because I had such a strong reaction to the antibiotics, but I do think that sometimes when people aren't super responsive to the antibiotics, it could be a fungal issue. And like what
I would
you're
agree.
saying, I've also been in the situation where I've had clients where I've said, maybe there's like a fungal issue going on, and I have to be a little careful as well, because I do remember one scenario where someone did sort of go down the rabbit hole and it was hard to reel that person back. And it probably wasn't a person that I should have been like, maybe we should have done a casual, like me sort of keeping it to myself and working on it behind the scenes, because there were certainly some options that we could have done. But yeah, I do think it's hard to know as a practitioner sometimes, like, should we go there or should we like kind of subtly do it? But I've definitely seen that before as well, where the anxiety increases and you go down that rabbit hole and it's not really helping,
No, it's not
and knowing
healing
that
for
they
some
have
people.
SIBO or have SIFO and SIBO. So yeah,
Well, and then they get scared and they label themselves as like a really tough case or an impossible case, and it could be a scary place to go. So yeah, I definitely have moments, and I'll say I learned that the hard way. a time or two with Candida, right. But also I went through this brief shining moment in my career for like a year or two where I was doing a lot of like 23andMe, MTHFR type stuff. And it can still be really insightful and like nerdy. I like it from the nerd perspective, but I don't use it diagnostically hardly ever these days. But I was kind of going there with the genetic SNPs a little bit more with my practice for maybe a year or two. And I got just kind of like nerdily interested in it and started dissecting pathways. And there was a handful of patients that I remember as like either as we were going through their genetic SNP results or after the fact, I remember regretting because they started Googling MTHFR all day night. And, you know, and it was like this spiral of like, I'm genetically doomed. Oh my God. And so I think I learned the hard way with that crowd more so. And then I started, I had a time or two with the Candida where similarly people would just spiral in the Candida thing. And I was like, okay, this is not productive. It's hard though, because I try to be like an honest person, and I'm really big on like teaching people about their bodies and helping them understand. And I joke with people, like, it's kind of like we're just plopped on planet Earth and we don't have a user's manual for this human body that we're given. So if I can help you write the user's manual so that you know how to navigate the ship in the future, then I think I've done my job well. So for me, like, there's definitely that very large chunk of my brain that's like, no, tell them, they need to know, be honest, and like, don't withhold things. But then I do need to be careful with some people, because the spiral and the anxiety and the insomnia from Googling all night is counterproductive to their healing, versus if I just layer in something that has a little bit of berberine or oregano in it, and then we're good.
Yeah.
With those particular people.
Well, and I think what you're doing is keeping the best interest of the person you're working with mm-hmm. at the forefront, because if they're going to be super anxious from doing going down this rabbit hole, then it's best they probably don't know, and you're still addressing it, so it's not like you're not addressing it in some way. So I think it's a hard dilemma sometimes, but again, keeping the best interest of the person you're working with at the forefront is, I think, the best way to go.
I agree. And kind of saving them from themselves sometimes is what it ends up being in that regard.
I wish sometimes I was saved from myself during my own SIBO journey.
Here you are chitter chatting with me. So it all worked out. Me drinking that creek water and you doing all of the things that you do. I'll never give myself a break for that. That's like the shining moment of my life. Let me ask you this then. And I will ask you first, and then I will reciprocate with my own response. Do you have a Candida diet that you recommend to people? Or is it really just like, you know, eat real food, nourish your body? Do you have any recommendations that you do give to your Candida patients when you are folding that into the mix? Or is it more just like, let's make sure you're nourished and no specific Candida-based recommendations? I'm curious.
Right. So I'm leaning more towards no specific recommendations. Typically when I work with people, sometimes we'll try to pinpoint if they have triggers or if they know like they're reactive to these foods, we'll cut them out as much as what makes sense. I mean, there are certain times where they're cutting too much out and we almost have to add stuff back in.
That's but usually in terms the people of, we see. The people who have already cut out way too much.
Right. So for me, I mean, usually the people that I'm seeing are already on some like deep end, off the deep end Candida style diet. So we are adding stuff back in. Mm-hmm. If there is a situation where we've pinpointed that Candida is an issue and they want to address diet wise, usually again, I'm mainly focused on nutrition. I'm usually not cutting out things like fruit or starchy vegetables or grains that they tolerate. We're usually not cutting those things out. Because like what we were saying before, all those things are really key to maintaining the systems that keep Candida in check. So
and also you enjoying your life and eating freaking food.
Right.
That is therapeutic too.
Yeah, that aren't going to turn you into a basket case with which again, I was that basket case when there was anything like sugary or carby. It becomes very all-consuming too if you're cutting out things like sugar and carbs, because I have seen, and I've heard this all the time from people where they're like, I am addicted to sugar. I have no willpower when it comes to sugar. And they're almost guilt tripping themselves that they like are craving potatoes or even like sugary foods.
Yeah, like,
but
bad you.
Yeah, exactly. And a lot of times like they're too low in carbs. So their body's telling them, hey, we need more carbs. Your blood sugar is a roller coaster trying to like maintain your glucose levels. And carbs would help that process. Mm-hmm. So typically I'm trying to get a read on like what their nutrition status currently is and how we can maintain that and individualize that. But yeah, I think in the candida space, I do get a lot of people that are like, I have cravings for carbs, and it's like labeled as such a bad thing.
Yeah.
But to me, it could be your body telling you that you need more carbs, especially, and that's more often than not, I'm like reviewing their diet log and it's lower than it should be, or that I think they personally need from a carb standpoint. So getting those up can actually help with the cravings because you're actually feeding your body what it needs.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of that too. Do you ever get that where people are like, I'm addicted to sugar? That.
Yeah, and I think, and I would say this, is it's kind of analogous to if you've ever interacted with somebody who goes vegetarian or goes vegan and then they start craving steak or burgers.
Right.
It's like your body's telling you you're iron deficient. That happened with my mom. I don't know if you knew this about me. I was a vegetarian for like 12 years of my life.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, when I was 11, this is like a rabbit trail, but I'll go on it anyway. When I was 11, my mom started a new job in a very crunchy town, Ithaca, New York. And when she started that new job, one of her new coworkers convinced her to go vegan because she wanted to lose weight. Side note, it did not work. And she was like, she literally came home one day and was like, hey, Nick, I'm going to be a vegetarian for a while. Do you want to do it with me? And I was just like, yeah, sure. Like, that's how laid back I am.
Yeah.
And also, I always said that meat was too hard to chew when I was a kid. Like, I literally complained that chewing was too hard. So I was just like, yeah, okay. And so we did this. And I remember my mom lasted like, I mean, maybe my perceptions were because I was 11, but I think she lasted maybe 3 months, six absolutely tops. And she was like, I'm craving steak and I'm craving a burger and like I need blood. And finally, she just gave into the craving and started eating meat again and the cravings went away. And I think it was that she was massively iron deficient and had no idea. And, you know, again, like in that space, it's like, oh, bad on you for wanting to eat meat again. But it's like, no, you're iron deficient. Your body's telling you something. So side note that I was lazy to a point that I was like, I'm just going to keep doing this. So then I was the only vegetarian in the family for many years. And it wasn't until I went gluten and dairy free and got diagnosed with celiac disease that I realized, okay, if I'm not eating meat, that's difficult enough. And I have to like bring a veggie burger everywhere I go if I go to a barbecue. But now I'm not eating the bread or the cheese anywhere. Like, whatever, I'm just going to eat meat. And I'm going to forego like the vegetarian thing. So that's the genesis of my vegetarian journey. It was 12 years of my life. And that was fine. Like I joke, I'm a recovered vegetarian. But I think it's, you know, when people are craving the carbs, it's similar. Like your body is sending you the signal that you need some carbs, particularly women. I mean, men almost always do well on low carb, honestly. But women, I think we genuinely, honest to God, need some carbohydrates to keep our hormones and our brains functioning and to sleep and like keep our cortisol from going wacko. So I think most often it's your body telling you that you need a nutrient and you just need to shut up and listen to it. That sounds so uncompassionate,
right,
but you know what I mean?
Right. I just think that like, to me, it's heartbreaking because I see it almost as a side effect of diet culture too. And even just what the messaging they're receiving in the SIBO or in the candida space, in the even the SIBO space, like, oh, carbs
don't
are bad, sugar is bad.
Yeah.
You have to follow these external rules diet wise and anything else is bad, but listening to your body is so important. And I really enjoy the process of helping people get through the mental barriers of actually listening to your body. I did also want to add too about the women aspect, because I 100% agree that from what I've seen, women certainly need a level of carbs different than men, for the most part. I would say, from my standpoint, I think that we're a little bit more nutrient sensitive because of, like,
We're the ones making the babies.
yeah, we're the
How
baby
young we are.
makers. We're the baby makers, and so our body's definitely very sensitive to nutrient status because that's the most metabolically expensive thing a human can do. So we're the vessels for this baby, and our nutrient status needs to be online and there for us to for our bodies to be okay with having a baby. So we're just very nutrient sensitive, and the hormones shift based on, carb levels and things like that more easily than men.
No, I agree. I think, honestly, I was just in my online class, I was talking about hormones yesterday, and that was a point I made. So on the low testosterone slide, I had like two slides on low testosterone. I was like, all right, guys, ready? It's easy. Men, you work out, preferably with heavy weights or high intensity intervals. Make sure you're getting zinc. Don't eat a lot of carbs. Certainly don't eat sugar. Maybe take some resveratrol. End of list. Your testosterone is cured. End of story. Women, it's a different ball game. Our hormones are much more complicated than men's. But yeah, I think men do generally well with low carb, certainly low sugar, because if they eat a whole bunch of carbs and sugar, they're just going to turn all their testosterone into estrogen, which is not what men typically want to see happen. With women, I think it's a lot more delicate and nuanced. And whether you choose to have children in your life or not, your DNA thinks that you're going to have a baby at any moment if you're a woman. And it's that like hardwired, survival mode, keep the species going kind of stuff. And your body is smart enough to realize when you can and cannot have a baby and make it go to term. And I think that it's a whole different animal with women, which is okay because we're different. We're superior to the men.
We're better.
Not
We're I
kidding.
think it's so interesting too, because I always talk to my clients and I'm like, well, like I try to say, like, we're the baby makers, and I feel like sometimes they're like, whoa, like I don't want a baby, but it's like
That's
what you're
cool.
saying.
Your DNA
Yes,
doesn't know that.
exactly. They're totally hardwired to want to reproduce the DNA that's in our bodies and have that carry on. So, but it is just kind of a funny conversation sometimes, like, we are the makers of the baby, and the baby needs a certain level of nutrients. And so,
Well, or even like, hell, and this carries through postmenopausally even. Like, if you're postmenopausal, maybe your carbohydrate need is a little bit less than premenopausal women, but I think that that still carries through because you're still a woman, even if you are postmenopausal. So, yeah, I think that restricting carbs, like actual food carbs, right? So, if you are a person who's like, I just got diagnosed with candida yesterday, do I have to give up my Pop-Tarts? Yes. Yes. I mean, like, for the most part, yes. Or, oh man, that I can't have ice cream every single night? No. So, if you're having genuine, like, shit food, sugar, then that's my dividing line. And that's what I would say my recommendation is for Candida diet stuff is like, if it's like Skittles and Pop-Tarts, yes. I think it would be wise to cut that out. A, because maybe you're feeding the candida, but also, yuck, it's not healthy and we have to get your body healthy and that's end of story. So I think, refraining from that stuff as much as is practical for the individual makes sense. But the moment you start saying like, I can't have that apple because it has sugar, or I swear to God, I don't know if any of my colleagues from school are listening to this podcast, but if they are, Simon, I'm going to call you out. I remember in clinic, we were at our like clinicals, we were doing rotations, and all of us interns were eating lunch in like the back room or whatever. And I had made this really great. It was like ground turkey, shredded up carrots, I forget what else, and then it was like a lettuce wrap kind of deal. And it was so good. And I opened it, I had microwaved it, I brought it out to the table, and Simon was like, oh man, that smells really good. And I'm a cool chick, so I was like, here, you want to try it? If you like it, I'll give you the recipe. And he said, oh no, I can't have that. Carbs have carrots. Or I'm sorry, carrots have carbs. Now, in his defense, he wasn't treating Candida, he was trying to get into bodybuilding. But I was like, if I ever say the words, I can't eat a carrot because a carrot has carbs, just shoot me now. That's like the whole nother level. My brain could not compute. I think there was smoke coming out of my ears the moment he said that. And I was just like, okay, more for
My
me. But
gosh.
I was gonna give him a bite of my lunch to see if he liked it. And yes, he could not eat carrots because carrots have carbs. So Simon, if you're listening to this, that memory will be forever in my brain. Just like it's a natural kind of dirty, Jill. There are certain memories that will always be in my brain. And I think that's the dividing line. If you start restricting actual whole foods and whole grains and, certainly the root vegetables, starchy vegetables, and fruit, I think that's where the Candida diet has gone a bit too far for most people.
And I do think like carrots are something that's under fire more than it should be, because I've
It's
definitely heard
carrot.
people like, I eat, or even just saying like, well, I eat carbs, I eat carrots, and I'm like, no, that's not
It's not
necessarily what
enough.
I'm thinking of with carbs. Like, yeah, they kind of are an in-betweener where they have some starch to them, but
Some.
I wouldn't necessarily say they're like a carb-rich food,
No.
like fruits and starchy vegetables like potatoes. So it's definitely one I see a lot, which frustrates me because they're like, well, I eat some carbs, I eat some carrots or parsnip or these ones that aren't necessarily gonna like meet your carb need because you ate a serving of carrots. So there's just a reference range. That's or a reference point that's so different between groups, because like you go to the Candida groups and like anything over 50 grams of carbs is like, whoa, higher carb.
Oh, yeah.
And then you go to a traditional American diet and it's like 300, 400 grams of carbs.
The muffins at Starbucks, and it's like 8 gazillion grams of carbs with sprinkled with sugar on top. That's what kills me. Like, why are we sprinkling muffins with actual granulated sugar? But yeah, that's the kind of stuff to avoid. Beyond that, just
Yes.
the best thing you could do, diversity.
Right,
Because
yes.
then you're going to get microbiome diversity and you're going to get inhibition of your candida and it's going to be rad. So the number one thing you could do, and actually, can we take another side tangent for a moment here?
Yes, for sure.
Have I ever told you about my Uncle Paul?
No.
Okay. Uncle Paul is super relevant in this conversation, both for SIBO and candida, and I'm probably going to bring him up again. I adore my uncles. However, my Uncle Paul is not the healthiest eater, and the only vegetable that the man willingly eats is carrots. So, man, watch out because you've got carbs, Uncle Paul. But, and he'll eat like pizza and shit food. But the only vegetable he will willingly eat is carrots. So it's like a running gag in our family that we're always trying to like trick him into eating other stuff. So at Thanksgiving, every single year, I make what I call carrots and white carrots. It's parsnips. But I make this and I tell him, and he figured it out like the first year I did this, and he just goes with it because he's cool. But I'm like, here, Uncle Paul, I made white carrots and carrots. It's your favorite. And he's like, okay. And he just eats it. And I'll never forget, I'm going to call my uncle to me the first year I did this. I was like, playing it cool. I'm like, yo, Uncle Paul, I'm peeling white carrots and carrots. Isn't that great? I'm going to roast them for you because we have to have carrots at every meal for him. And he's like, oh, okay. And my Uncle Timmy, from like the other room, from the living room, he goes, aren't those parsnips? Those look like parsnips. Those are
Oh
parsnips, right? And I'm
gosh.
like, shut up, shut up, shut up. I'm trying to fool him.
My
Shush.
gosh.
So anyway, so Uncle Paul figured it out real quick, thanks to Uncle Timmy. But yes, I cook in that. But anyway, the point of this being, I always use him as an example. There's a point to my story, I swear. I use him as an example because my Uncle Paul could eat 30 servings of vegetables every week. But if he's only getting 30 servings of carrots, he's only ever going to feed the bacteria that like carrots, and he's only get the nutrients from carrots. End of story. So the poor bacteria in his gut that really like blueberries, or the poor bacteria in his gut that really like, I don't even know, like tomatoes, they're just going to be sad and starve for the rest of their lives, and they're going to die. But he will have an overabundance of the bacteria that really like carrots. So the whole game with diversity is if you eat a wide variety of plant foods, you're going to feed a little bit of food to everybody, and then the whole clan can be happy. So now, to kind of contrast it, you could take my Uncle Paul, in theory, and he's eating 30 servings of carrots per week. I don't think he does that, but he could. and he's getting 30 servings of vegetables, but it's one type of vegetable. Or you could have another Joe Schmo from the street who's eating, I don't know, like we're like picking people off on the street in Cincinnati or something. But you could talk to another person and they're eating 20 servings of vegetables per week, but they're having 20 different vegetables. Like that person's going to be way better off and they're going to be less likely to have candida and dysbiosis and inflammation because at least they're getting the diversity, even though the total amount of vegetables could theoretically be lower than the scenario I just painted. So that's actually my number one nutritional recommendation for anybody who's dealing with candida is try to get the diversity up. Because then you'll feed your microbes, they will inhibit candida, and then you'll all go frolicking off into the rainbows and the sunset and be happy together.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's easier said than done, but that should be the goal moving forward.
Right. I wholeheartedly agree. I think typically with me, when I work with clients, like the first steps are just making sure their nutrition's adequate. So overcoming the humps of like food fears and those issues, making sure their calories are where they need to be, and then kind of at that point focusing on diversifying the diet and fine tweaking the diet is typically what I do with most clients. But I think you're totally right. In a candida situation, it makes a lot of sense that you're building up the ecology of the microbiome as a whole and in feeding different microbes so that you're preventing any overgrowth of things like candida. And I think the same thing would go for a lot of bacterial imbalances too. Like you want to make sure that you're feeding a variety of different microbes to prevent things from getting out of control.
Yeah.
Kept in check, as you like to say.
Yeah, exactly.
So I think from a treatment standpoint, I know there's a lot of different options from a fungal standpoint, whether it's herbals. I know there's conventional stuff as well.
Yeah.
I know we mentioned it. Go ahead.
I was going to say, side note, I don't recommend the RX stuff. There was
Diflucan and Nystatin.
Yeah. I mean, not typically. Now, I will say this. The freaking conventional medical world is all too happy to give out antibiotics like freaking candy still. But then they'll give you shit if you try to get Diflucan. At least this was my one experience. I went in for like a chronic cough. I went into urgent care. I told the lady specifically, I don't want antibiotics, but I'm here for your medical opinion. If I'm legitimately dying, I'll take the antibiotic. She sends me home with a prescription for an antibiotic. And then when I asked her, oh, BTW, I don't want to get a vaginal yeast infection. So could you also write me a script for one round of Diflucan? You would thought I asked her for 8-ball crack cocaine. She looked at me with this face of like, oh, and she's like, well, I'm concerned about your liver. We should really test your liver enzymes. I'm like, lady, I test my blood. I do blood work on myself at least once, if not twice a year. My liver enzymes have literally never been elevated aside from when I was doing Lyme disease treatment when I was 14.
Yeah.
It'll be fine. Give me one pill of Diflucan. But you would have thought I asked for something illegal, the way she looked at me and the way she got real serious and started like, well, I don't know. Like, she had a come to Jesus moment with me over one pill of Diflucan. So, but that being said, there was an interesting study. I forget what year it was. I think it might have been a 2016 study, but I only stumbled on it a year or two ago, where it was a mouse model, but nonetheless, they gave the mice, I think it was like Diflucan or fluconazole. Gosh, me and words today. I don't know what it is. But they gave them some sort of prescription antifungal, and they showed that, yes, it brought down candida very efficiently, and it brought down, I think it was Penicillium species, very efficiently. But a whole bunch of other types of yeast way went up. And now it manifested as fungal dysbiosis where, all right, like you got rid of the candida, but now there's all these other yeasts that are overgrown because the candida is gone. And then in that model, I think it made them more prone, like the mice started exhibiting like allergic airway disease, if I remember correctly.
Hmm.
And then they were like, well, was it the microbiome piece of it? Or was it, you know, a side effect of like the drug in the liver or something? So they took the microbiota out of those mice who now had fungal dysbiosis, implanted it into other mice, reproduced the same allergic airway disease.
Whoa.
Yeah. So it was a really interesting paper. I can email it to you if you want. I have the PDF
on
my
computer
somewhere.
Yeah, I don't know if I've seen that one before.
It was really wild, and it made you kind of go, oh, so obliterating your fungi, like SIBO, right? Like just going in and dropping an A-bomb on your bacteria probably is not the right way to go for most people, at least certainly with the prescriptions. I don't know. There's never been a study that I know of that looked at, you know, like caprylic acid doing the same thing.
Right.
But certainly the heavy hitters like Diflucan or something like that is probably just going to manifest more as fungal dysbiosis. And then that's has the potential to be a lot worse. So I think, you know, don't eat sugar, put away the Skittles, whatever it might be. Eat things that your microbiome will like fiber and FODMAPs,
right,
and polyphenols and like colorful foods. You could do natural stuff. I do like the undolinic acid. It cracks me up that Thorne's product is like the worst name on planet Earth. Formula SF722.
I know.
Like, am I a robot now? What? Who named this? What meeting? What staff meeting did they name this at? But it's a marvelous, marvelous product. And I'll usually use that in conjunction with like caprylic acid.
Yeah.
And then maybe I'll use something like monolaurin, and maybe I'll use, God, what is the herb that is escaping me today? Powder arco. Sometimes I'll use powder arco, or sometimes I'll do like a blend, but typically a lot more of the work on my end is going to be trying to get the microbiota online. And
right.
Also sometimes the immune system, and trying to boost TH1 immunity or boost natural killer cells and get that immunity logged online for the fight. But otherwise, I don't frequently drop an A-bomb on the candida. I don't think it's wise to do that.
Right. No, I agree. I think that it's interesting what you're saying about that study you were talking about with the Diflucan, because it's almost similar to an antibiotic. Like, if you take an antibiotic, it's going to go in and maybe kill one thing, but create all this other dysfunction.
Yeah.
So it's almost in a similar way doing the same thing, but just with fungal issues.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's really interesting. I think, again, with the fungal stuff, I think doing the diet diversification is really key. I think I like a lot of the same products you just mentioned. Mm-hmm. I really like undisoclinic acid. That's kind of my favorite.
That's my go-to, honestly.
Yeah, exactly. That's my go-to as well. I would say definitely doing things that might help hormonally and the, again, with other things too. I mean, I think stress management can be key.
Huge.
Taking care of yourself, sleeping enough if you can, again, unless you have like a new babe or something like that, that's really disruptive of sleep.
I mean, still you should be trying to do that. Like I remember not a lot of sleep when Jess was young, but we would pretty much pass her off to my mom and like, go take a nap.
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
There should be an effort to sleep as much as is practical and doable for you, but realistically,
right.
it's tough if you have
right. I think that from what I've seen, doing a lot of things that help hormonally and the brain-gut axis still are really important for fungal issues too.
And the leaky gut thing.
Yeah,
if you have leaky gut plus candida, then healing the leaky gut and working on that could be really profound for the candida thing, because it's like the candida doesn't have as much of an attachment point anymore. Like it can't really root itself in your system quite as aggressively, and you're not getting exposure to those, you know, bits and fragments of particles of candida and particles of yeast and whatever else is getting through the leaky gut.
Right, and that's something we didn't like really mention, but that that candida can turn into this like hyphal form and really root into the gut lining, which sounds like a horror movie a little bit. And I think you're totally accurate. If there's a deep-seated fungal issue like that, taking care of it and really working on getting the gut lining back in balance so that you have your defenses up to prevent it from rooting in, and to also keep just the yeast in check in general. I'm in total agreement with you on that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a running theme of this podcast. This is why we are co-hosts, because we tend to agree on a lot of things. But we also, we're learning a lot from each other too. I mean, I know I have. So
it's been great. I think that It'll be interesting if we get to an episode where we like totally disagree
Duke it
on
out.
something. Yeah,
Oh
like,
yeah.
oh yeah, like, can't
I
believe
don't
you'd believe that. What?
know what topic that might be in the
I
future,
know,
but
I don't.
theoretically, watch out.
Yeah. We might need to, like, I don't know, make up a fake fight just for the drama. Just to add some drama to the podcast.
There you go. Yeah, we'll just make like a weirdo one-off YouTube video and it'll be weird and fantastic.
Yeah, we both have to wear maybe like a poop costume or something. Just
No,
to add to the flair.
the thing that would be dangerous is one day, someday, over the rainbow, once the pandemic is done and we can meet people in person again, we shall rendezvous and we shall have podcast recordings in person.
My
And oh
gosh,
my
wild.
gosh, that's going to be a freaking hoot. I'm already looking forward to that day. So stay tuned, America slash the world, because someday we will record from the same room and visit each other, and that'll just be a freaking hoot. So
That'd be
that
awesome.
being said, though, I feel like, let's see. So we hit the high points for Candida. I feel like we touched on the whole nutrition thing, which is kind of a big freaking deal. We touched on the sugar thing. As an aside, we'll wrap up just momentarily, but I remember seeing a study. I think it was just like a petri dish study, so take it with a total grain of salt. But they gave Candida glucose, and then they gave it fructose, and the Candida wanted nothing to do with fructose, but it was all about the glucose. Have you stumbled on that as well? I forget
Sounds
where I
really
stumbled on that.
familiar, but I
Yeah.
can't think of what where I've heard that before. But
Yeah.
I've heard that concept before.
Like I said, I think it was just a petri dish study that I saw it in, so take it with a grain of salt. But that's all the more reason why fruit is not as likely to be hugely problematic versus, honestly, you know what the worst Candida thing that I've had in my life was? When I did a damn glucose SIBO breath test. Because they give you, I mean, I don't know about other brands, but Aerodiagnostics gives you like 3/4 of a cup of granulated glucose, pure glucose. And I've never been so hypoglycemic in my entire life. It was
Oh
very
my
scary.
gosh.
But B, to a point where like now I'm actually much more cautious with who I do glucose tests on, and I really try to favor lactulose and getting that prescription whenever I
Right.
can, or slash just not doing a SIBO breath test at all. But I have never been so hypoglycemic in my entire life. And also, I gave myself a full-blown vaginal yeast infection from the freaking SIBO test. And I was so annoyed because I just did the SIBO test for my YouTube channel so I could make an instructional video.
Yeah.
And I was just like, well, I'll be damned. All right, well, this was super not fun.
Did you talk about it in your video? I want to, did you like kind of go off?
I think I did a check-in. I definitely said at the end of the video that it made me very hypoglycemic because that
Oh
happened
my
the same day.
gosh.
But
Yeah.
I think I did a YouTube video checking in later on about the vaginal yeast infection. I can't swear to that though. Now, I might have recorded it and then forgot to post it. I'll
Yeah.
have to look at that. But yeah, SIBO breath test, glucose gave me a mad vaginal yeast infection. And I
Oh
was
my
so annoyed because I
gosh.
was like, well,
No.
it proves the point. But like, I eat fruit, I eat whole grains, I eat some degree of sugar in my day-to-day life. But that pure, unadulterated, massive amount
Yeah.
of glucose really fed whatever yeast I had. And it took me a week or two to fully recover from that,
Right.
doing all the
Yeah,
hippy-dippy natural stuff.
and I think it's also important to note too, like for those solutions and even like sugary drinks too, if you're drinking something that has literally no fiber, like it's just going to be
Yeah.
processed as straight glucose in your system.
You're drinking Mountain Dew.
Right. That's where it gets to be problematic, I think, from a potential fungal issue.
So I would say I think reduce the shit food, the
Right.
the ice cream, the Skittles, the Pop-Tarts, whatever it might be. The soda and liquid sugar, certainly. But as far as like sugar from fruit, I don't know. At least the one study seems to indicate that fructose is not as big of a deal. And certainly, A, if you're buffering the sugar with fiber, and also if you're feeding your bacteria with the fiber, I think that the whole food versions that have some carbs and some sugar are less likely to provoke symptoms. But anyway, we could talk all day. This is a very dangerous podcast because we could just keep jibber jabbering forever and ever. And I love it, and I love
Right.
you. But I do think it's about time for us to wrap up. So, guys, as always, thank you so much for tuning in. If you are listening on a podcast app, if you could please rate us 5 stars in the App Store, that would help us reach more people. And also, if you are on YouTube, if you can click the bell, click the like, leave a comment, subscribe to the channel, whatever you do on YouTube, Any of that will also help us reach more people and help heal the world of Candida and SIBO and IBS and dysbiosis and all of the things in between. So thank you so much for tuning in. Amy, I'll see you next time. It was an absolute pleasure, as always.
Yep. See you next time.